This episode of the 9-8 podcast is proudly brought to you by Flair Audio.
Hello and welcome, listeners and Patreon subscribers, to the 9-8 podcast, the home of everything progressive and underground right here in Australia. My name is Alex Hogg, and every show I'm joined by Mr. Dave Ellis. Hello, hello.
G'day, g'day. How we doing?
Before we jump into today's show, a quick reminder to everyone that if you aren't subscribed already, please follow or subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening. Leave us a review and share the show with your prog like-minded friends. This helps us greatly expand the reach of the show and get more new listeners to the 9-8 podcast.
Absolutely. And we like new listeners.
We always like new. It's always great when we have more new people listening to this show, because more often than not, they send us some music recommendations from parts of the world that we're not exposed to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we do have quite a few actually backed up in the email. So which we are getting through. So we do apologize if we're being a little tardy. Things are kind of a bit weird in this end of the world, as those of you who have been watching news and all that kind of stuff might have realized.
Yes.
But what we should do is we should probably start with a bit of follow-up, as per usual. Hoggy, the Chaos Divine show, how was it?
Yeah, so a couple of weeks ago now, this is how weird it was. It was like a couple of weeks ago before we went into a lockdown, and then subsequently before we came back out of a lockdown again. Went to go and see Chaos Divine. The show was great. The songs sounded fantastic. And they closed the show with The Door, which is one of my absolute favorite Chaos Divine songs. It's a really, really beautiful song. The one thing that I did actually want to talk about, there's two things I want to talk about. The opening act actually was one of the opening acts was called a band called Om Rune, which is very interesting. Just a two-piece. A dude with a bass guitar and a drummer. But he was doing some interesting things with loops and different effects of pedals to turn the bass guitar into an actual guitar. And looping that sort of stuff and then singing over the top of it. It was really, really interesting. Chaos Divine is more at the very much at the metal end of the prog thing. So naturally their opening bands are essentially just like, you know, really heavy metal bands.
Yep.
So it was more towards that end of it, but it was really, really interesting music and very interesting to see what you can do with the technology with a two-piece.
There was a two-piece I saw a few years ago that opened for Cog, and I can't remember the name of them for the life of me, but it was just a drummer and a singer. With loops behind it.
This was like he was playing the guitar part, and then you could see he was stepping on pedals to make the loop play forth, and then he would play other stuff over that and then loop that and all the rest of it.
That when there's a will, there's a way, right?
Totally, absolutely. Reminds me of another band I saw years ago. They've now since split up, but there was a band called Race to Your Face. Again, two-piece math rock, drummer and guitar player. Okay. And he would do all sorts of weird loops and loop things over the things, and it was all very complicated math rock. Very interesting. Very, very talented guitar player. No idea what happened to him, though. The band split up, and now the record is available on Bandcamp for nothing. You pay what you want sort of thing.
Interesting.
So, yeah. The other thing that I wanted to mention, actually, was for the very first time that I've actually seen, usually when you go to these sorts of gigs, if you want earplugs, you've got to ask for them at the bar.
Yep.
At this particular gig, they had a giant bucket of foam earplugs sitting by the front door. So you sanitize your hands, grab earplugs out of the thing. Yes.
Oh.
It's really interesting. I mean, this was a pretty young crowd, young kids in the gig. For the longest time I've been going to gigs in this city, usually I'm the lone idiot wearing earplugs.
Yeah, but you're not the idiot when you walk out and you pull them out and you go, oh, look, I can hear. And you see the other bastards walking out, like trying to like shake their ear out, thinking that, you know, if they put their finger into their ear far enough, it'll get rid of the new tinnitus that they've just developed.
Yeah, it'll get rid of the noise-induced tinnitus they've just been subjected to for the last 2 hours.
Exactly.
I mean, we can expand on how the sort of scene has changed. I remember 10 years ago when I saw Metallica, like I remember getting called a pussy by some bloke in the pit because I had earplugs in and he didn't. I mean, that may say something more about the sorts of people who go to see Metallica than it does about the changing things of the scene.
Yes,
but
probably.
It's really interesting because a lot of people were actually wearing earplugs.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually fantastic. I think people are just becoming more aware of health, and the reason I say that, and this is a bit of a sidestep, right? Because we never do that in this show. As you know, Hoggy, I am a lover of coffee. I drink a lot of it. But I drink decaf.
Me too, man. Me too.
Unlike you, I have to drink decaf, right? So I've kind of gotten used to decaf. And the good thing about decaf is that you can figure out where the good coffee places are, because if their decaf is good, their normal coffee is excellent, right? Because it means they've got a decent turnover and so on and so forth. What's been really interesting over probably the last 3 or so months here in Sydney, people are starting to run out of decaf. So when I've spoken to people who were the regular coffee shops that I go to and so on and so forth, I've been asking them over the last few weeks, you know, hey, are you actually running out of decaf? Are people ordering more? And they're like, yeah, they are actually. But why do you think that is? Oh, I think people are getting a little bit more concerned about caffeine and things they put in their body and all that kind of stuff. So it's probably a symptom of a larger, you know, good issue in that people are becoming more wary about health and things like their hearing, you know, their, you know, dare I say, you know, their teeth and, you know, their overall fitness and, you know, caffeine and drinking. Drinking has gone through the floor here in Australia as well. Which is really, really interesting as well, considering we are known around the world as boozers.
You know? We drink, well, typically, I mean, the many people, you know, in the sort of, you look at the demographics of it, a lot of people drink a lot of alcohol in this country. That should be a surprise to no one, you know. Maybe because people's perceptions of Australia are changing overseas and people are starting to see that, you know, Australians are being seen overseas as basically just a bunch of dumb, drunk, racist idiots.
I mean, it's not entirely incorrect.
We haven't exactly done a lot in the world to kind of dispel people of that myth. But I want to bring it back around to earplugs again.
Yes.
Because it's very interesting that how they had it set up, usually you got to ask for them behind the bar. Mm-hmm. Some places just straight up don't have any at all.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about, you know, the punters, the people going to the gigs, are more concerned with the earplugs. But also as well, it's obviously a marker from the venue owners.
Mm.
You know, the owners have probably had a whole lot of people ask, oh, do you have earplugs? You know, oh, I didn't bring any with me. Can I have some earplugs?
Mm.
Haven't got any, and they will bugger it. We'll put some at the front door. And I bring all of this up because this episode of the 9-8 podcast is brought to you by Flare Audio. Flare Audio's mission is to develop new and advanced sound technologies that improve, protect, and enhance our sonic experience. Now, I've been using the Flare Audio Isolate earplugs for years. My wife actually bought me a pair on the original Kickstarter campaign for Christmas 1 year, and I've used them at every single live gig I've ever been to from then. They are super comfortable to have in your ears. I mean, to give you a perspective of that, I have had these earplugs in my ears for 3 entire days of a festival that I went to in Madrid, the Mad Cool Festival.
Uh-huh.
9 hours a day, and the last day was actually 12 hours. I had them in for the whole day because there was always music playing around. It was always really loud, and I'm just like, I'm putting these things in. I have hereditary tinnitus. I've had it ever since I can remember. My mother also has it. And so I've always worn earplugs at gigs.
Mm-hmm.
For the longest time, it was always foam ones, but then my wife sent me these ones and I've used them ever since. They're really, really comfortable. They block everything out, but they also it's mostly blocking out the sort of reverby parts.
Mm-hmm.
It still provides, it's super clear. You can still hear everything. It's not muffled at all. And the bit that I like in particular is that they sell a special cord that goes around the end of the earplugs, so you can take them in and out and sort of leave them around your neck if you're sort of stepping in and out of gigs or moving between venues.
Mm.
Very important for me because I have lost many an earplug in the pit or trying to dig them out of my pockets, all this sort of thing. For the best hearing protection and the most comfortable hearing protection going around, check out their awesome range by clicking the link in our show notes below. And so for the news this week, we're going to start local and eventually move ourselves out into the wider world. So starting here very locally in Perth, friends of the show, the Daniel Wiggins Group, are releasing their debut self-titled album on September the 25th this year. And they're debuting the album at a gig in Fremantle. Now, here's something that I've not ever seen done before. Tickets are $15 for this show, and included in the copy of, in the price of the ticket is a copy of the record. That's particularly innovative, so I reached out to Daniel Wiggins and asked him, and he said this, quote, "Originally I was considering having the CD included with all sales, but I restricted it to tickets pre-sold before the gig to hopefully stimulate those pre-show numbers."
That's interesting.
It is. What are your thoughts on that, Dave?
I think it's a really smart marketing campaign. You know, I've often wondered this for some time, with CD sales in particular, and particularly vinyl record sales and so on and so forth. And it started happening a couple of years ago where you would buy a physical copy of the disc and then you would get a digital download as well. Because let's be honest, most people were just slamming it into their computer, ripping it, shoving it on their iPod, and that was about it anyway. The CD would sit on the shelf, right? Now with Spotify and all those streaming services, it's kind of a bit useless, to be honest.
It's certainly what I've been doing with my CD collection for all this time now. Also as well, that digital download is particularly useful if you live in, I don't know, a far-flung desert hellhole like I do. And stuff takes 6 weeks to ship to you from America. If you can have that digital download, you can still listen to the record. And then when the CD turns up, you can have a look at the artwork or read through the lyrics or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Right? So it's a
vinyl,
really...
even better, because, of course, as far as I'm aware, there's no real way to rip vinyl to MP3, although I'm sure you probably can using some external software plugin stuff.
Yeah, there definitely is a way to do it. But the thing that's interesting about this is the fact that the tickets are, it's only $15 and you get a copy of the record. So, you know, if it were me, I'd probably make them 30 and you get the copy of the record with it, but that's just probably me being greedy. But it is a really, really good idea to do that, because if by chance, if you look at it from a pure marketing perspective, right, if he's selling tickets at $15 and with that you get the copy of the record. Now, how they do that is the interesting part. So I would wager, and I haven't seen this, so I'm just spitballing here. What I would probably do, and what I reckon is probably has happened here, I'd wager it, is they probably don't give you a copy of the album. They probably give you a code to download it through an official source, like, you know, your iTunes or your Amazon or your, you know, Google Music or whatever in the hell it is, right? So then
Bandcamp.
That will actually
Bandcamp.
Yeah, or Bandcamp, absolutely. So with that, if let's say, for example, you had 150, 200 people going to the gig, right? All of a sudden, you'd have 150, 200 downloads on that. You'd have 150 to 200 downloads of that, and that would actually go into your artist stats. So that could potentially push you up the charts. And if you be pushed up the charts on a lot of these things, including Bandcamp and all that sort of stuff, they often have, you know, what's happening in your area and all that kind of stuff. So
yeah, you get pushed up into the sort of whatever the version of like the new and notable in your area is, or your genre is.
Exactly. And then there might be a case of, oh, this is new and notable. Oh, I like the music. And hey, they've got a gig coming up. Cool. I'll buy the gig and then buy a ticket to the gig. And then I get a copy of the album. Oh, okay, cool. You know what I mean? So
In this particular context, the record is being debuted on the night of the gig. So you don't get it before you do. So I'm pretty sure it is a physical copy you're actually being handed at the door.
Ah, okay. So that's interesting. It sounds expensive. I'll be really honest. It sounds like a really expensive way to do it.
If it gets people to actually turn up to the show, though, that is then part of the thing, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great, great idea as well. But it definitely sounds like an expensive way to go about it. But hey, if it works, it works. Proof is in the pudding.
The other thing that I would be doing if I were running this show, I would be collecting email addresses from everybody who walks into the door. Yeah. Okay, you may not be getting the CD, but you'd be getting everybody's email address.
See, that's why I reckon the other way that I was talking about would be the smart way to go about it, because you would have to have an account to do that, and then you would just say, cool, here's the code, download it. Oh, and by the way, to download it, we're going to send it to your email, the actual link to your email. So give us your email. Boom. Then you've got their account. You've got their so you've got all their listening habits and what else they're listening to and so on and so forth. You can use that all for marketing metrics. You've got their email account, which you can use for direct marketing, and you've got your Boon in the actual
Rather than the SEO type stuff, I'm thinking more about the direct marketing of like you've got the email address.
Yeah.
Facebook does a surprisingly shitty job these days of promoting posts to people.
Mm-hmm.
So like you need to, Facebook does an appallingly shitty job at that now.
Yep.
I mean, it basically doesn't really work anymore.
Yeah, that's why you need people like me to do your marketing for you. Hint, fellow listeners.
this is why social media marketing is such a boon, and it usually involves throwing money at it.
Basically, yeah. Yeah. That being said, you can get a lot done for $50. But anyway, we're digressing.
That is true. We are digressing. So anyway, there you are, my fellow people of Perth. If you are in town on September the 25th and you are interested in listening to some new prog music, go and grab a ticket to the show. Link in the description.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Stepping out one step wider, we have The Omnific. Their new record, Escapades, is out on September the 10th through Wild Thing Records. Now, we discussed their lead-off single on the last episode that we did together, Dave.
Yeah, so we did listen to that one, and they've got a brand new one out as well called Antecedent, I think is how you say it. I don't know. Anyway, they've got a brand new one out. It's the second lead-off single from their upcoming album. It's actually featuring Clay from Polyphia fame. It's interesting. It's more of the Omnific's, quite trademark bassy stuff. And this time they add in a third bass player. So it's really interesting to see the two takes on that and the way that they actually sort of go about doing what they're doing. It is definitely worth a watch. Obviously, we'll put the link to the new track in the show notes below and where you can order this album as well. Hoggy, what did you think of the new track, by the way?
I had not seen this until you mentioned it to me. I didn't actually see that they'd released a second single. Mm. I've had a bit of a listen to it now, and it's very interesting. The third bass guitar thing, that definitely adds something else as well, like a different style than their usual styles.
Yeah, but look, it's promising. It sounds pretty good. It sounds quite interesting as well. You can pre-order Escapades through a whole bunch of different links. We'll put them in the show notes below, and it's out on September 10. So moving along, we're stepping out now. Out of Australia, we're going international acts. Leprous have announced that they have a new album coming out, actually only next month in August. Inside Out Music are releasing that one for them. It's called Aphelion. Lead track off that one is called Running Low. What are your thoughts?
I really like this one.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
very cinematic. And the addition of strings,
yes,
is something I don't think I've done.
Like, yes.
There's now basically what appears to be more or less part of an orchestra playing along with them.
Yeah.
Which is awesome.
Yeah. It was awesome. I remember hearing it and I was like, oh, it started off, kind of typical Leprous kind of stuff. I was like, okay, all right, that's interesting. It's all there. And then the strings come in. Oh, this is awesome. It just really lifted everything. It's great. So good.
Yeah, it's fantastic. If this is an indication of what the record is going to be like, it's going to be great.
Absolutely.
I do notice, however, that they did not announce a specific date for when this record is coming out. They said August. Mm. Presumably so they don't end up in the same situation that Pearl Haken did, where they had to delay the announcement, delay the release of their record three times.
I'd suggest they've probably got a couple of release windows there.
Probably, in case the vinyl doesn't turn out. Actually, I was reading something Tim Bonus was talking about a new record he's got coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Much smaller project than anything he's done with No Man or Stephen Wilson or whatever, rah, rah. And he's not doing it on vinyl.
Okay.
And someone said to him, why? And he said, well, there's a couple of reasons. One, there's a 6-month lead time on vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
It's really expensive, and I don't think I'd sell that many copies of this particular project that he's working on.
Mm.
So the whole concept of vinyl becomes, some people might like vinyl, but if you're only going to sell a few copies of it, you've outlaid a horrendous amount of money to make these things and have them pressed and all the rest of it, and then no one buys them and you're stuck with a garage full of them.
That's right. Yeah, that's kind of the issue with vinyl, right? It's a great resurgence and it's awesome if you're a big band, But if you're a smaller guy, what baffles my mind are these people who have got, you know, nine followers on Facebook, four of which are relatives, one's their girlfriend, the other one's their grandma, and they're going, oh, yeah, we're going to do a run of vinyl. And you go, why? You know, it's not...
Or the other one, and the other, you know, nine followers and the other one's like a sock puppet, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's like, why would you put something out on vinyl? It's just stupid, you know?
Unless you've got a really big fan base that are committed to the vinyl and want to hear it on vinyl, then it works. Fantastic.
Yeah, exactly.
Or you're like an older artist who's reissuing their back catalogue on vinyl.
Yeah.
Fine. Exactly. Okay. Cool. You know, if people are there to buy it, that's fantastic. It's great for you. Well, actually, speaking of vinyl, different friend of the show and unofficial third host Joshua Batten got in touch with us and told us that, okay, this is not necessarily prog, but I'm going to use this as a jumping off point, that Lorde was releasing a new album.
Yes.
Download code and vinyl only. No CDs.
Yes.
I mean, I can understand why they're doing that. I don't suspect that there's too many Lorde fans out there eagerly harking over the fact that there's a CD release.
Mm.
But I imagine there's quite a few people who wish to buy it rather than stream it. And I dare say there's quite a few people who would like to have the thing on vinyl because, you know, vinyl. Where the CD thing doesn't really make any sense. You don't have, I mean, at least with the download code and like digital downloads, you never have to worry about the thing going out of print. You don't have to keep printing CDs for people to have in their record stores because, well, record stores, A, don't really exist, and B, people aren't really going there for the CDs now. Like the vinyl section at at the JB Hi-Fi near me is three times larger than the CD section.
Yeah, no, it's...
So...
It is definitely changing and changing quite rapidly as well. So, you know, as I think we've said before on the show... It will become vinyl. Will be, you know, the collectors and the people who really love it and all that sort of stuff. And everyone else is just going to stream stuff
or download it. I thought. I still find the concept of actually paying an artist for money and receiving music in return to have as a copy of, you know, something that still appeals to me. The streaming thing. I think I've said this before, and I'm probably just retreading old ground, but I use streaming as mostly like a farm system where I listen to a bunch of stuff, and if I really, really like it, I will go out and buy it.
Yeah, but I mean, this is similar to what I've been doing for years, and back before streaming was a thing, you know, that we had that wonderful thing called LimeWire and Kazaa and all that kind of stuff and torrenting and everything. And, you know, I mean, there have been albums that... You know, you would download through that way or through, you know, a share site or what have you. And I always said at the time, you know, I would much rather do that, you know, download a band's entire catalog and then go to the show and drop $300 on tickets and merch because I know that they're going to get that money.
Yeah.
You know, as
this presupposes that the band you're listening to is actually going to tour this country.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing as well.
I guess in Sydney, there's a slightly higher percentage. There's a slightly higher percentage of that happening than me over here.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to get quite a few people here and see quite a few people here and so on and so forth. So, you know, and there are albums that I've bought just because, you know, it was the only way to get it and so on and so forth. A lot of stuff I've had to hunt down on old, you know, record stores and things like that. But
Discogs is good for that too.
Yeah,
finding stuff that's out of print.
Yeah, it is. It's really, really good for that. Mm. So, but yeah, so, I mean, again, digressed. But Leprous, new album. It's going to be fantastic, I think.
Absolutely, it will be. Alrighty, stepping out even further again, we have the new Till Lindemann song.
Yes.
Ish-has-kinder? Have I said that right?
No, you haven't. Ish-has-kinder.
Oh, fantastic. Please don't tell my wife.
That's all right. I shall try. I will try not to. I'm surprised she's not beating you over the head already.
No. The backstory to this is that, you know, for those of you who have only just recently joined this show, I am appalling with languages. I really am. I try very hard, but I still suck. And even, Dave, do you want to tell the story of how long it took me or how many takes it took me to say on an episode about Weltschmerz?
And
I probably still said that wrong now.
Weltschmerz, yeah. I can't remember. It was funny. I just remember there were so many.
Yeah.
There were successive episodes too, but I mean that you've got the heart. That's all that matters. You know, maybe.
Yeah. But that may matter to you. It certainly doesn't matter to the people in my life around me who mock me for the pronunciation. But anyway, this is all superfluous to the idea. Now, the reason why I'm bringing this song up is because, and I don't mind saying this at all publicly, I've said it enough times to the people in my life, is that my wife and I are child-free. We're not having children.
Yep.
Because the translation of this particular song loosely translates into I hate children.
That's the literal translation.
This song
to
has
it, yes.
shown up on so many forums that my wife and I belong to. It's a bit like that old meme, you know, if you look to your left and look to your right, you'll see this fucking post again.
Mm-hmm.
I saw this so many times.
Mm-hmm.
However, I suspect that okay, I've listened to the song. It sounds pretty much like any other Rammstein song, you know, and it fits the formula pretty well. Shocking title, graphic film clip, and a song that I have no idea what he's actually singing about. This is where you come in, Dave.
Yep.
You speak German.
Yep.
Is it really about how much he hates children, even though he has, like, children of his own from numerous relationships and so on and so forth?
Okay, so here's the thing, right? The thing with Rammstein is, yes, they're a brutal and quite a shocking band with a lot of the stuff they do, you know, flamethrowers on stage and riding big penises that are like coming into the crowd and such. Yes, that happened, people. Go look it up. So
they get arrested for that at one point?
No, I don't believe so. Maybe they did. I don't know. Anyway.
I thought they got arrested for that because it was like, you know, the vulgarity or something of like, you know, giant big penises shooting stuff into the crowd.
Oh, I don't know, mate. Maybe. Who knows?
But that is kind of the whole point of Rammstein's bit, right?
Yeah.
Large portions of their audience don't speak or understand German, so they kind of have to put on a show to make it interesting for... If it were just like a series of dudes on a small stage with none of that stuff singing stuff in German, I don't think it'd have the same appeal worldwide.
No, I don't think so. And the music is actually quite simple as well. So, you know,
yeah, that's
I mean,
true.
Most Rammstein stuff is da 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 da. You know, that's the whole song, right? So it's not,
yep.
It's not exactly like you're going to get the musos sitting there and going, oh, that was really cool. You know, it's just, it's fun.
The music is a vehicle to tell the ridiculous stories that they're telling.
That's right. And that's exactly what this is. The story in the actual lyrics is really, really. It's actually quite funny. It starts off, he says, ich stiege in ein Flugzeug ein, which means I'm standing in a plane. And I'm sure at this point you can figure out what's happening without even figuring. So, he says, I'm in a plane. It's cold, or it's becoming cold. I hear it screaming. So the first two lines.
Okay, now I get where we're going with this.
Yeah, okay. And he says, you know, ich kenne meine Sitzplatznummer. I know my seat number, or I know where I'm sitting, or I learn where I'm sitting, and panic begins to set in, basically, because I'm sat next to this demon child that's fucking screaming its fucking head off, right?
You know, something that I'm pretty sure everybody can relate to.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, this baby sat next to him, and then the pre-chorus lyrics is hier die Frage aller Klassen, darf und kann man Kinder hassen? You know, here's a question for everyone. Should people actually hate kids, right? And then it's, you know, ich hasse Kinder, et cetera, the next verse is basically about, you know, the kid's going off its nut. The mother's sitting there reading a magazine, eating an apple. You know, the father's fucking sleeping and this kid's going off its nut, right? So we start to.
Oh God, I'm just getting like flashbacks to basically every transcontinental flight I've ever taken in my life.
Exactly right. So then, you know, it goes into again. The second chorus is a bit different. It's, you know, I hate ich hasse Kinder. Nein, ich liebe sie. Ja, ich liebe sie. Die großen und die kleinen. What's the next lyric? Doch es müssen meine sein. So I hate kids. No, actually I love kids. Yes, I do love kids, the big ones and the little ones, but they have to be my kids.
Yeah.
Right. So it's the whole thing is realistically, and then there's actually a really funny bridge as well, which is like, you know, the kid gets quiet. And it sort of does a little, you know, the little cute things that little kids do and sort of like babble and giggle at you and all this sort of stuff. And Till goes to reach his hand out to say hello, and then it goes off its nut again. So, so what's really interesting though is the outro. Now, the outro has a really interesting line in it, which is, hier kommt die Frage aller Fragen, kann und muss man Kinder schlagen? I.e., so here comes the question above all questions, or, you know, the question, the biggest question, right? Should we hit children? Right? And then it's no.
It's very interesting that these lyrics are juxtapositioned by, like, him getting his head kicked in by, like, people. Like police and all this sort of thing.
You've taken the word out of my words out of my mouth. So what's really interesting about this, and I know I've said that a few times, but what's really interesting is the film clip for this. So the film clip is kind of like, you know, the story of this kid going off its nut, and he's sort of questioning, you know, I mean, should I just slap this kid and shut it up, basically, right? Kind of like that TV show The Slap, which is also a book. You know, should I do that? Should I step in? The parents are obviously not doing anything. This is a societal thing, you know, where parents seem to let their kids get away with fucking murder and everyone else has to fucking suffer for it, et cetera.
And presumably Till is referring to time in his life where, you know, it takes a village to raise a child, and if you saw a child on the street misbehaving, there would be no compunction from the people to step in and sort it out themselves.
Absolutely. You got to remember that Till...
I'm not saying you got to kill the kid. I'm just saying you sort it out, you know.
Absolutely.
Stand up straight, show respect, you know, that sort of thing.
Exactly. And you got to remember that Till and the rest
of the
guys
grew up in
East Berlin.
The sort of thing that if you tried to do in today's society, you'd get smashed.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, and that's exactly the thing. Now, the juxtaposition of that with what's going on in the film clip, you've got someone who's basically running around saying, I hate children, I hate children, and he's like brutally murdering people, right? What I can't figure out in the film clip is whether or not he's the kid that's getting bullied and then he's exacting revenge on the people who used to bully him at school. I kind of can't quite figure that out, if that's what's happening in the film clip. Or if it's just a juxtaposition against, look, this is what kids do. How cruel is that? How is that any different to someone doing these things? In actual fact, in today's society, if those things were happening to a kid, we'd think it was worse. You know, I'm not quite sure what the juxtaposition is there. And I realize that I've been ranting about this song for ages, but I love this song. His previous one as well, the previous Till Lindemann one's kind of pointing to the fact that there might be an album coming out. And I am... fucking all about it. But the song itself is actually quite funny, because it's something that anyone who's ever taken a flight to anywhere, I mean, when I was flying over to see you, you know, I'm getting on the plane and we're looking around. Our plane was slightly delayed by a little bit, you know, and I'm looking around and there's like four families of kids. I'm like, oh, fuck off.
And you're just like, oh God, here we go. The reason why I'm saying, like, you know, about transcontinental flights is because for the longest time, whenever I used to fly to Europe, I would always insist on an exit row seat because I need to get up and stretch my legs. I need to get up multiple times during a flight, da da da. It's always easier if I'm in an exit row than like in amongst all the other people, because then you got to like wake people up to move them to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And so the problem with that is that, yes, you're in the exit row, but you are more often than not stuck next to a series of families who have children in bassinets that are on, like, stuck to the bulkhead.
Yep.
So the trade-off is that, yes, I get to get up whenever I want to stretch my legs and do other things on a flight, but I will always be stuck next to a screaming child without fail.
Yeah.
Always, because that's just where they end up.
We've all had those things. So the actual song itself is actually quite interesting.
Wonder all the people in my child-free group were all over this song, because even if they don't speak German, they probably looked up some translations on the internet and were like, oh, because this is a popular topic on the internet of, like, should there be, like, adult-only flights? And this song speaks directly to a more or less, you know, argument in favor of such things.
Oh,
you know, having, like, adult-only sections on the planes. Mm. I don't necessarily agree to that, but that's not the point.
No, I don't particularly agree to that either. Yeah. Do I think there should be age limits for kids that are flying? Absolutely.
Oh God. Like, okay.
not going to get into that.
Shall
one.
We move on?
But yeah. So yeah, new Till Lindemann song. It has a Kinder. You can check that out. We'll put the link in the show notes below. And you definitely should check that one out. Now, final part of the news here. Marillion Weekends have been announced for 2022. You're the Marillion fan of the two of us, Hoggy. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so they're doing one in Sweden. They're doing one in Poland. They're going to go back to Montreal again, which is going to be great for people there. They're going to do one in England. Now, there's sort of the centerpiece of the whole Marillion Weekends, the one that they've been doing in Port Ceylan, the one they've been doing there since 2005, I think. That has been postponed to 2023, thanks to COVID, thanks to Brexit. The band can't do this gig next year because they put the gig on. Basically, the short version is they put the gig on themselves. They're the ones who have to get insurance for it. No insurance company will give a band like COVID liability insurance anymore. So if they have to pull this gig because of some Dutch lockdown or an outbreak or whatever, they're the one who's stuck footing the bill. And apparently that bill will bankrupt them.
Yeah, I mean, that would
nobody
not
wants
surprise
that.
Me.
Yeah, nobody wants that, especially me. So the other part of it is that they're planning to live stream one of the gigs later this year. They're doing like a tour around England. So they're going to live stream one of the gigs at the Hammersmith Apollo, which will be great. I hope that they live stream some part of the weekends as well, because I strongly doubt that anyone outside of continental Europe will be able to fly in to see any of these weekends. And for the one in Canada, I doubt whether even the Americans are going to be allowed to fly to Canada to go and see it.
Maybe, maybe not.
Who knows, depending on what happens by this time next year. So yeah, that about ends the news. Now we're going to jump into our main topic. Now, the main topic of this episode has come from me. I heard this particular album as a recommendation from my wife. The album that we are going to talk about is by a British group called Black Midi and their brand new album, Cavalcade.
Yeah.
Now, let's start somewhere that we probably agree on with this record. How awesome is this album cover?
I've got to admit, the album cover is actually very interesting. What I kind of want to know is how it was made. I mean, it kind of looks like a really bad 90s just mismatch of shit, but then you kind of look a little bit closer and looks like maybe it could be like an oil painting or one of those like spray paint paintings that people do on the streets and things, you know, with the cards and they move stuff and all that. And then it's kind of not, and I don't know. It is really, really, really cool.
I think the album cover in itself can be a sort of a summary for what I think the record is. And I'm going to sort of hang this line over the top of it and then we'll continue on with the thing. It looks like chaos, but it's very carefully orchestrated chaos.
Yes.
Like, it looks, at first glance, you go, oh, God, that's, you know, busy and kind of a mess. But then when you look at the details of it, it's like, hang on a minute, this has been very carefully orchestrated and planned. And nowhere is that more evident than the very first song on the record, John L.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all right, let's get it out of the way. What did you think, Dave?
This is a great example of why you have to have the best track as side one, track one on an album. I almost turned it off about halfway into this track. It was not pleasing to my ear holes. And I want to stress that it was not pleasing to my ear holes.
Yeah, because I think this song is the best track on the album.
Yes. And I can understand sitting down and actually sinking teeth into it and all that kind of stuff. I fully agree with you. It's probably the most technical. It's probably the most interesting so far as layers and what's going on and actually having to sit down and dissect it and all that kind of stuff. I wholeheartedly agree with you. Do I think it's a good song, though? Not really.
Depends on what you want out of a song, though.
Agreed,
like, this is very much a headphones album. You sit down with the headphones on and you listen to the thing, preferably in a darkened room.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe with the film clips going on as well, because those things are wacky as hell when there are film clips for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I said before, yes, it might sound like complete chaos, but it's very carefully orchestrated chaos.
Mm.
And I actually find the lyrics to be incredibly clever. One thing about this particular band that I enjoy the most is the fact that there are multiple people with lyrics and multiple different people singing the songs on the record. You've got a couple of different members of the band who write lyrics, and a couple of different members of the band who sing, and they all have their own different style.
Mm.
One of them sort of sounds a bit like Scott Walker, which we'll park that point for the moment and come back to later. So in this particular song, we have some sort of leader. Presumably his name is John 50. Mm-hmm. This could be any one of a whole bunch of different leaders. It's left deliberately ambiguous about who they're referring to. This could be almost anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Whipping the crowd into some sort of frenzy and then being dethroned. I mean, there's a line in the song, "No hack with an army will last long before he breeds men who yearn for their own bloody glory."
Mm.
One could argue that it's some sort of fascist dictator, judging from the third verse. "Children of Bethlehem, come all boys and girls, come listen to these my eternal words. Judge not who you see by whatever they may say, but by their round eyes, lips, ears, and curves. A man is his country, your country is you. All bad is forewarned, all good would come true."
Mm-hmm.
You could draw that line to basically anyone, you know, the sort of goddamn immigrants coming to take our jobs kind of thinking, or some sort of medieval person where, you know, we've got these outsiders coming in and they're here to invade and destroy us all, and I'm telling you that it's coming. Whatever. So there's many, many different ways that this could go, and it is left deliberately vague. Even the members of the band in interviews have left it deliberately vague about what it's about. I will get to one of those interviews later. I'm just going to put that there and move forward.
Sure.
Because then after this completely wacky off the wall song, which obviously has to draw its influence from King Crimson in some way.
Absolutely.
There's a bit of that sort of 21st century schizoid man kind of feel to some of the instrumentation and the way that it's all put together.
Mm-hmm.
And as I will reference later on, at least one member of the band is a particularly big King Crimson fan, so it does not surprise me that the Crimson influence is there. I think I introduced this album to you as like King Crimson if it were fronted by Captain Beefheart, because there's maybe a little bit of that and some sort of Zappa kind of influence there too with some of the lyrics and some of the ways that the melodies have been constructed, I think. But then we jump into a song called Marlene Dietrich, which is the complete opposite of like a world building and a different vocal style. It's sort of building the image of a dark, smoky club and a once glorious, now faded singer coming up to the microphone to a captivated crowd. So the layers underneath this thing, it's an incredibly dense song with lots of the layers with the sort of vocals over the top. This is one of those ones that I sort of kind of figured sounded a bit like sort of an influence from Scott Walker, but not really. I mean, what do you reckon, Dave?
I actually quite liked this track.
Really?
This actually reminded me a little bit of Tom Waits. And I'm a reasonably big Tom Waits fan. Also, it's Marlene Dietrich. And Marlene Dietrich was actually a German. She was an actress, I think, from memory, or a singer.
I think possibly both.
Yes, well, she was around in that time where, you know, it was, I think she started in the silent film era and then went into talkies and all that kind of stuff, but she was like 1910 to like 1970 or 1980 or something like that. So she, you know, across quite a fair walk of stuff. So it's interesting that they've got a song named after her. Now, I haven't actually read the lyrics of this song, but I actually quite like the song itself. I think it's actually a really good... quite a nice track. See, this is the track that I would have chosen to lead the album.
Interesting. We'll get into record sequencing a bit later, but I think that the alternating between the sort of carefully orchestrated chaos and these sort of quieter songs, because it does do that. It goes from complete chaos to this song, and then the next song, which is, bear with me while I try and pronounce this, Chondromalacia patella, I think, yes, is how you say it. I am probably butchering that so badly, and I apologize for that.
Chondromalacia patella.
That's the one. Thank you. Again, like, it sounds like it's completely carefully orchestrated chaos again. I've no idea what he's singing about. I've read the lyrics, and I'm like, what the hell is this about? I have no idea.
Chondromalacia patella is actually knee pain.
Yeah, it's a knee pain condition. Yeah. It's a generally comes about with old age.
Yes.
But the song has got nothing to do with that, as far as I can work out anyway. But I find it oddly compelling. But again, I'm figuring that this song is one that threw you slightly because this vocal styling is, of the ones that are sung in this style, is the one that closely reminds me of Scott Walker. And yeah. I swear to God I didn't pick this album deliberately to wind you up as here's a song that sounds like Scott Walker. Ha ha ha.
No, I actually didn't mind this one. The funk elements in this one is actually really, really quite nice and quite interesting. There's a lot of jazz there in the middle and such as well. What does throw me a bit is that singing, if you can call it that, singing style. That kind of really over-the-top Whaley kind of sound, like you're standing in a room and recording from 20 feet away and there's just echo everywhere and all that sort of stuff doesn't really do anything for me. Strip that away and listen to the actual music and such behind it. Actually really good.
It's
actually
the other thing about this particular record is that it's very much music first, lyric second.
This album to me kind of seems like a whole bunch of people got together, wrote a whole bunch of stuff and just kind of slapped it together. That being said, the lyrics that you've mentioned already so far are actually really interesting. So it's kind of like they all know exactly what they're doing and it works together. It kind of feels like they've shoehorned it all in to work together, if that makes sense. And it kind of works, but it kind of doesn't. That's what I'm saying about the sort of carefully
orchestrated chaos.
Yes, and I agree wholeheartedly with you on that. Yeah, absolutely. What I do find interesting is that the app that I have up, which will remain nameless, that I'm listening to this in, gives me the play counts as well. And what's really interesting is watching the play counts drop off as you go down the album. So it starts.
Isn't that
off,
all the albums though?
Yes and no.
Isn't that the case with pretty much everything? Like people start listening to a record and then they go off and do something else and they just stop the play or whatever?
Look, yes and no. I mean, it's interesting because this is a very definite downward trend. You know, normally with albums and all that sort of stuff, you have a little bit of a drop off, but you know, you might start at like track one might have, say, you know, a million listens, and then track two might have like 800,000, and track three might have like 850, and then da da da, and it sort of does that kind of sort of drop off. This is really interesting. It starts at 1.5 million plays, and by the end of it, it's 300,000. So there's a definite drop off. So I wonder whether or not people sort of get, the further they get into the album, they're just like, I can't do this. I can't keep going. You know what I mean?
Or it's part of one of those things where people sit down to listen to the whole thing because, you know, you can't do anything but with this record. It is very much a sit down, listen to the whole thing. But they have to go off and do something else, so they stop and come back to it later or something.
Mm.
I'd be very interested to see what that is for, like, something like The Astonishing, for example.
So you mentioned about The Astonishing. I've actually just looked it up. It jumps all over the place. So track one is 1.8 million. Now, to be fair, that's The Descent of the Nomax, so, you know, that doesn't really mean anything. Next one's Dystopian Overture. So from there, I'm just going to go down. 3.4 million, 4.3 million, 2.8, 2.6, 2.2, 2.5, 2.1, 1.8, 1.7. And then The Hovering Sojourn, I'm assuming, is another Nomac one, which has 4,302.
Wow.
And then Brother Can You Hear Me, 1.3, and 1.6, 1.4, 1.6, 1.2, 1.0. 1.2, 1.5, 1.15, 1.
Okay, so it sort of stays around the same. It's down from the first couple, but not as precipitous a drop-off as what you've seen. Although, actually, when you think about it, in terms of raw numbers, from the start of the record to the end, it's basically halved.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
well, this one sort of did the same thing. Didn't you say it sort of went from like a million down to, million down to like 300,000. Yeah, okay. Fair enough.
So, you know what I mean? So it's interesting. I just find it interesting. Mm.
I do particularly find that Nomac one incredibly hilarious because those things just add nothing to the damn record.
No, definitely. Yeah, we've talked about this on previous ones. If you want to hear us talking about The Astonishing, go back and find the episode about it.
We can put a link in the show notes to that. We did, that.
Now,
just as a point of interest, Dave, I was going to say, just before we do that, move on, have you actually listened to that record again since we did that episode?
I have, yeah, actually, yeah.
That's interesting, because I haven't.
No, I have listened to it. It came on one day when I was doing some work in the garage, and I just kept it on, and it's like I said, it's not a bad album. It's just missing something. So anyway, next track, Slow.
Yeah, this one starts out as like the most King Crimson-esque of the lot. I had Fracture in my mind, which is this completely banana pants song that they sometimes play live and spend weeks rehearsing because it's just nuts. Again, completely different vocal stylings from the first two songs, different attitude to the melody. You know, as I've said before, this band is very much a music first, lyrics second kind of band. And the two are very much not created at the same time, which is interesting. Almost as if they needed to, like, find a place for the lyrics to go in and around this complex music, as opposed to the music being, like, a vehicle for the story they're trying to tell.
Yeah.
Now, I don't care if I'm wrong, but this one has to be about lockdown. Like, maybe I'm just reading into it because I just so happened to be in a lockdown when I was listening to this record again.
Possible.
But, and I wonder just how long it took to get there, I guess I'll wait. How much longer? Any day. How much further must I wake? I guess I'll wait.
Look, I mean,
again, that might just be my particular context of listening to this record in a damn lockdown that informed me to think this is about lockdown. I don't know. What do you reckon?
It could be. I don't think it is. I think it's about conditioning in society, you know, where people are told just, you know, all good things come to those who wait. So take it slow.
which we both happen to know is a damn lie.
Absolutely. You know, it's also kind of, for me, it references that idea of your what got you here isn't going to get you there. You know what I mean? Because there's that line there, to get there. You know, I wonder just how long it took to get here, to get there. So, you know, I guess I'll just wait. And because, you know, good things come to those who wait, right? But I start to get a bit antsy because I don't know how much longer I've got to wait for it. And you start to get a bit pumped up and so on and so forth. Again, this is another one of those ones that I actually quite liked. The jazz elements and so on and so forth really came through. And this is it's a very tech jazz album. But it's good. I mean, it's not a bad album. Rather, it's not a bad track. Yeah,
I mean, yeah, again, the very carefully orchestrated chaos, and then the lyrics that sort of weave in and around that carefully orchestrated chaos. Very technical in that way.
Yeah.
I mean, the next song, Diamond Stuff, again, it's a big shift from the madness of Slow. It starts off with one acoustic guitar and things sort of moving around behind it. This is where I get to the part about the sequencing of this record. Let's say you sort of did this record on vinyl and side one was all the crazy, mad, semi-atonal stuff. It would be an exhausting slog to listen through.
Yes.
And if it were the other way around, where you had all of these sort of slower, more moody, atmospheric pieces all together, they'd all sort of roll into one, a bit like Tim Bonus's last record, Last Night Laments, where we just ended up like... Well, all of these songs they're all in the same sort of mode. They're all this sort of slow, melancholic sort of thing, and they all kind of roll into one song, really. Splitting them up like this, I think, gives everything a bit more definition in there. Okay, here we go. We've got, like, crazy, mad technical stuff, and then this sort of where you take everything away and it becomes, like, a vocal piece. And then you move into, like, Dethroned, which sort of starts in that place but eventually builds into this relentless, the relentless, carefully orchestrated chaos again before cutting off very dramatically right at the very top of that.
Yes.
It's only at, like, this point in the record that I realize that this song may actually be some sort of story concept kind of thing. And it could be telling the story of the same person. Gets to the point. Well, somehow he still thinks today is just a blip. The footnote that ends his entry at the center of all self-respecting encyclopedias. And I'm thinking, this is probably still John 50 telling his part of the story, but now he's like, okay, it started off with what it was like when he was flying high and he was like the man and everything else like that. And the rest of the story is alternating between the clarity of what happened to him and like the descent into madness as he dreams of his rise again. Like, who knows?
I mean, picking that up and running with it, it absolutely could. I mean, if you take the chaos of the first one, right? For example, it could be a particularly violent revolution, and that could be what it's symbolizing. So John L., violent revolution. Then it goes into Marlene Dietrich, right? So Marlene Dietrich, could have been, for example, a way to talk about, you know, propaganda and films, and everyone's sort of settled into a uneasy, normal sort of life and all that kind of stuff. Patella, obviously knee pain, so the guy's getting older. And then slow, you know, sort of toward the, not the twilight years, but things are, you know, starting to just get to the point where it's like, you know, how much longer have I actually got to stay here, you know, before there's another violent uprising or what have you. Diamond stuff, I'm not quite sure how that fits in, but then dethroned, obviously, you know, could very well be the fact that this guy's suddenly been dethroned and, you know, worrying about, you know, as you say, then the raving lunacy and so on and so forth as he descent into madness because he's been, you know, dethroned and so on and so forth.
Or even concerns about legacy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, so, I mean, then we've got Hogwash and Balderdash as well, which is, you know, that next track as well.
Yeah, that just sort of goes on from where Dethrone finished off. The music underneath with the raving lunacy of the main character on top is
yes,
fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although I'm guessing by this point, Dave, you'd probably almost tuned out and bailed on this record, just of like just the relentlessness and the sort of just crazy stylings of it all, right?
No, look, I did give it a listen. I always give it a listen. This particular track, I actually found the intro really, really interesting. Don't ask me why, but I thought of a Haken song for the very start of it. I don't know why. And I can't think of the name of the Haken song right now. It's the one that starts very, very similar to this anyway. Very, very proggy, very heavy album. A very heavy song, rather, by them. Because it's got that sort of digga 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 sort of thing going on. And it's really, I actually quite like those sorts of effects and those sorts of, it's that sort of soundscaping and so on and so forth. I actually find it really interesting. And I mean, Hogwash and Balderdash could be about his state of mind if we're taking it, continuing on with the theory as well.
Could very well be, yeah. Because then we move forward into the final song on the record, Ascending Forth, which I'm guessing is John 50 accepting his fate as yesterday's man and dealing with like the fallout of his failed regime, potentially.
Mm.
References to men in chains and presumably him like writing stuff in prison. There's references to things like that. It's a very interesting tone to kind of take out the record and sort of finishing off as like him sort of as yesterday's man in a way.
Yeah.
Maybe it is about Donald Trump. I don't know. Because that seems to be what he does now, writing a blog that no one reads and him complaining about that people are marginalizing his readership. And it's like, yeah, but dude, no one actually listens to what you were saying. No one listens to you anymore because you are yesterday's man, effectively.
Mm-hmm. What is interesting is if you have a look at a quick Google search about Cavalcade, the actual, there's a, on NME, there's a summary of the album, and that is the album is the band have already shared Prog League signal Jong L along with Chaotic Visuals, envisioned as, quote, a jet black comedy about what happens to cult leaders when their followers turn on them.
Jong L, maybe it's like a Jim Jones, I don't know, like a Jim Jones sort of thing,
yeah,
or who
could,
knows?
Could be. I'm not 100% sure.
John L.
Yeah, now we're trying to figure out who the fuck they're referencing.
It could, like, this is the thing with these sort of things. It's probably a pastiche of any number of a dozen characters we could come up with. Mm. You know, Jim Jones, L. Ron Hubbard, Donald Trump, Boris Johnson, anybody.
Absolutely.
Could be anyone. This is often the case with these sorts of things. It's never usually about the one person. It's unless they're telling it like that record, Black Swallow, where it was literally telling the story of one particular gentleman's life. These things are commonly like a pastiche of many different people and many different, you know, leaders or revolutionaries or whatever you want to call them.
So just as a bit of real-time follow-up here, the band say the record is envisioned as a procession of different larger-than-life figures, such as a cult leader, an ancient corpse found in a diamond mine, and cabaret singer Marlene Dietrich. So it could be just a whole cavalcade, which would work with the song.
Yeah. So it's not necessarily about the one person. It's just about a collective of people yeah. who all have had these similar sort of experiences, potentially.
Yeah. Yeah. When you're listening, you can imagine all the characters form a sort of cavalcade. There we go. Roll credits. Each tells their story one by one, and each track ends. As each track ends, they overtake you, replaced by the next in line. So, yeah.
Okay.
Interesting. Interesting.
Very interesting.
So, yeah. Look, at the end of the day, though, would I necessarily listen to this again? Fuck no. It is not. This is not my thing at all. Do I appreciate that it's it is actually, you know, a very, very, very well put together album and technically brilliant? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I can't take that off them.
Yeah. This for me is probably going to land somewhere near the top of my list as a record of the year. I think this thing is amazing. And I have listened to this record multiple times in preparation for this episode, and I will continue to listen to this record multiple times in going forward. I think it's fantastic.
I think this is probably a great example of the two of us and what we've spoken about on the show before, which is you're very much more influenced in the, I call it the wacky jazz kind of prog. You know, the stuff like your King Crimson, the stuff with your Alt Nouveau jazz and all that kind of stuff. And whereas I'm probably more from the more traditional school of things, in that I like, you know, your rocky metal, you know, all that kind of stuff with a beat that I can sing along to and so on and so forth. So, you know, it is interesting that the two of us have such different ideas.
Oh, totally. This is the idea. I mean, you could almost see, I used to be like, you know, we used to talk about ourselves as me being more sort of the Euro prog end and you being more of like the metal kind of thing. Mm. Now that I think that the Euro prog thing has, for better or worse, essentially run its course now, I don't think there's anywhere else that's progressing in that direction. There are a couple of bands that still do it very well. Unfortunately, most of these bands are pretty well established now. I mean, the five that I can think of that immediately spring to mind are Frost, IQ, Marillion, Pendragon, and Anubis.
Mm.
Everybody else is just ripping. Everybody is just ripping off Genesis.
Yeah.
And I know that there is one particular person who listens to this show very religiously who's going to be very unhappy with me saying that. But those are the bands that I'm thinking of when I say that. The rest of them, I could take or leave. To be honest, it's just like there's nothing new here. There is nothing, and this genre, but where the new stuff is happening in that, look, putting aside the metal, what is happening in the new space, in that space, is mixing noise, jazz, and sort of grime music together with progressive elements.
Mm.
That's where I think the fun stuff is happening now in that space, aside from just straight up metal, like the sort of the metal and the very sort of blues, rock, metal kind of bass stuff. I think the interesting stuff is happening in this genre now.
Absolutely. And that is where the next, I think the next big stuff is going to come from. You know, big.
Probably where people now who go to music college or whatever, all of these guys unsurprisingly met at music college. So, you know, you don't get to writing that sort of stuff by accident. There is a lot of, you know, intense musical training that goes into putting that sort of thing together. So I think that sort of music is probably what you're going to come up with next, sort of jazz fusion mixing other stuff together.
Mm.
Whereas the metal is sort of pretty much all, you know, that's always going to sort of be there, that sort of progressive metal sound and people chasing the Dream Theater, Haken, Queensryche, Iron Maiden kind of stuff. I think that's pretty much always going to be there. So to wrap this thing up, I have a piece of follow out. We don't usually do follow out, but here it is. In preparation for this episode, I listened to another podcast called Talk House, which is a podcast run out of a radio station in Chicago. And they did there was an episode with Morgan Simpson, the drummer of Black Midi, talking to legendary superhero prog drummer of all the great prog bands, Bill Bruford. And they actually recorded this together, I think, in Bill Bruford's house in England, wherever he lives now. And the two of them had a really interesting chat, and they're both fans of each other, Bill Bruford particularly liking Black Midi, and Morgan being a particularly big fan of Bill Bruford's drumming. The stuff that he did with Yes, the stuff that he did with Genesis, the stuff that he did with Earthworks, the stuff that he did with King Crimson, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to put a link to that podcast in the show notes because I think it was a very interesting chat. Not necessarily about, there's a little bit about how the record was made and that sort of thing, but mostly it's a discussion between two drummers about music.
Mm. Okay, that's something I'll probably have to check out.
Yes, absolutely. So I think that about wraps up our main topic, so we'll jump into the album reviews.
So, the album I gave to you last time was a bit of a change of pace, actually. Laura Meade's The Most Dangerous Woman in America. What did you think?
This is a great story. Very compelling, but I had no idea who she was singing about.
Mm-hmm.
The story of a woman whose voice was silenced and whose story was all but forgotten about in her home country is a very compelling one, done very, very well. Lots of different musical interludes, different styles being mixed in. It was really interesting.
Mm.
But after listening to the album, I was like, okay, I got to find out. Who is this about? The detail is so compelling. It can't be like we had with Black Midi, like a pastiche of different figures throughout the world sort of rolled together in one story. So I started reading around some reviews, which I usually don't actually do. I don't read a lot of reviews of records that I'm trying to work on for the show. But after I listened to it, I'm like, okay, I have to find out who is this. And there was one particular review, which I'll put a link to in the show notes, which mentioned Gene Seberg, who was a Hollywood icon from the 1960s, big in the sort of the golden age of Hollywood, that sort of thing, who supported the civil rights movement, who gave money to the Black Panthers back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And the FBI essentially harassed her out of the country, leaked bold-faced lies to the press about the father of her child, which subsequently died after birth as well, and she was in the position she had to hold an open casket funeral to prove that the father of the baby wasn't what the press, what the FBI had leaked to the press.
Mm-hmm.
And she was effectively blacklisted from Hollywood. And then the FBI continued to harass her when she fled to France and died in suspicious circumstances, which was ruled as a suicide.
Mm.
After she died, the FBI released documents essentially admitting to the whole disgusting ruse that led to... And this was during the times of, like, J. Edgar Hoover. And this is well documented that J. Edgar Hoover essentially ran the FBI like his own personal protection private... police racket, going after people who he thought were communists, going after people who supported.
Where else have I seen that recently?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, wow, what an original concept, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, so J. Edgar Hoover was using it like going after people who he thought were communists, going after people who were supporting the Black Panthers, all sorts of like really disgusting crap. And none of the presidents that he served under stopped him because apparently he had dirt on all of them.
Yeah.
So, like, Richard Nixon was being personally updated about this particular operation to drive Gene Sebring out of the country. It's fucking disgusting.
Mm.
There's a whole lot more that I read about this afterwards, which I'm going to have to skip over for the purposes of this podcast because we could go down a whole rabbit hole of all the crap the FBI got up to in the 70s, which is totally disgusting.
Oh, yeah.
But once I read this, I understood why there's a bit in French on the record and why there's a line in one of the songs that says, "Forgive me, I cannot live with my nerves," which is a direct quote from her suicide note, by the way.
Mm.
The title of the song, End of the Road in Hollywood, and constant references to persons unknown following her. It's an album that I'm going to return to because it's super interesting. The story is incredibly compelling and it's fantastically written.
That's
like two thumbs up from me. Yes.
Because it was...
Did you know about any of that before I gave it to you?
I did. And that's why I didn't want to say anything. I was just like, I'm going to see what comes out of this. Because
so
it came up
on my list.
It came up on my list as I, you know, listened to a new prog album. And I was like, okay, I started listening to it. I'm like, this isn't prog. What the fuck? And then I started listening a bit more. I'm like, okay, there's some interesting shit going on here. So I looked it up and I was like, okay, this is a concept. Right. So it sort of twigged at that point and it's a fantastic album. I really, really like it. And that's why
did
I gave it to
you. Did you get to the part about all of the things with Gene Sebring and J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI running around, running people out of the country? Did you get to any of that?
Yes, I did.
Ah, you did. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
And it's, yeah, considering the things that are going on in New South Wales at the moment, it is, oh, yeah.
Remarkably prescient, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so there you go. Glad you gave it two thumbs up, and I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Fantastic. So the record that I gave to you was by an Australian band called Voronoi. The record is called The Last 3 Seconds. What did you think?
Super cool. Really, really, really groovy. You know, very, very interesting. It reminded me a bit of a band called Euphoria, and I've referenced them a couple of times on this show. I don't know why, it just had that kind of, you know, vibe about it. It's actually really interesting because as I was listening to it, I'm like, oh, this is great music to have on the background in, say, like a cafe or while you're working or, you know. And then it went to like another track and I went, this is not a great one to have on at a cafe, you know. So, you know, it's one of those albums where you could totally have it on in the background while you're doing something. You could just leave it to play and so on and so forth, and it would probably not bring you out of anything you're doing. But if you really want to sink your teeth in, there's some super cool shit in there as well. So, you know, it toes that line quite well. Definitely going to return to it and have another listen and actually sit down and, you know, fully immerse myself in it and give it another crack. But definitely worthwhile. Definitely worthwhile doing it. It's a great album. Really, really good album.
Fantastic. Glad you enjoyed it. Alrighty, so what have you got for me?
This time I've got a completely bit of a different album. It's a prog album. It's quite cool. It's by a band called What Strange Beasts, and the album is called The Maestro's Tales. Only released about 2 weeks ago, so check that one out. What have you got for me?
So I have a record that has also only just been released a couple of weeks ago. It's by a Brisbane-based band. The band is called Chasm. The record is called Falling Forever.
All right. I'll check that one
out. Sorry. Yeah, hang on. Sorry. Let me tell you again. Yeah, sorry. The record is called Falling Forever. So check it out. Tell me what you think.
Cool. Easy. I will check that one out, and I'll let you know what I think on the next episode of the show. I think that just about wraps it up for today and for this show. As always, thank you guys for listening to us talk about music and talk about a whole bunch of stuff going on in the prog world. It's been a lot of fun.
Yes, it has. It's always very interesting when we end up with a record that has like polarizing opinions. I remember we had this with the Tool record, where it was like, you really loved that record and I thought that record sounded incredibly rushed and was like deadly boring. With this record, I absolutely loved it. You sort of, you know, it was very interesting, but basically couldn't stand it.
I think that's the difference, right? A lot of people, polarizing opinions in today's day and age seem to be you either love it or you hate it, right? In my opinion, what it should be is you either you like it or you can appreciate it. You know, that's the way I've always approached it. I don't like something, you know. I will find something in there that I can appreciate and I can, okay, yeah, cool, I appreciate this, I appreciate that, you know. Even on the most basis of pop crap that you hear on the radio, right, the production's fantastic. So you can appreciate that and you can learn stuff from that, right? This album from today, I can appreciate what went on. I wouldn't necessarily go back and listen to it again, but I can definitely appreciate all the stuff that's gone in there, and I know that there's a lot of stuff in there that's probably above my head. As well. So, you know, there's probably stuff to learn from that as well. And likewise with the Tool album, right? I'm sure that there was stuff that you could appreciate in that as well. You just didn't like to listen to it.
Yeah, there were things I appreciated. And the problem that I had with it is that I would have thought after 15 years that would have come up with something that was a bit more different sounding rather than just almost exactly the same.
No, I understand that.
So, yeah, that was my problem with that record. So that about wraps it up for this episode of the 98 Podcast. If you want to find the show notes for this episode, you can find them at the98podcast.fireside.fm/73. You can find us on Twitter at 98FM. You can find our Facebook page at facebook.com/98FM. And as we said at the top of the show, if you like what you hear and you wish to support us even further and get some bonus content, including some bonus interviews and that sort of thing, which we give exclusive access to our Patreon subscribers before they go on the feed, you can check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/98FM. Thank you very much for listening to this particular episode. My name is Alex Hogg.
And my name is David Ellis, and we'll see you on the next episode of the 98 Podcast.